right. Well, I as many of you who are listening have been doing a lot of series around really kind of heavy hitting topics, like things like my friend Katie came and spoke about her journey with breast cancer, and I've been doing some episodes around vaccine injury, and I just feel like topics that honestly I wanted to talk about because I feel like it's so important to hear other people's stories. For, I mean, gosh, a lot of reasons, anywhere from preventionary reasons, or even just for people to not feel isolated in like whatever they potentially are going through. And so I have asked a wonderful woman named Kat to come on to talk about something really, I think that. Well, first off, I'll say I know it's not uncommon in terms of grieving the loss of a loved one, but also to just talk about grief, to talk about loss, and to be not only just, I mean, I hope an encouragement to a lot of people who may be in similar shoes, but also maybe even give insight to people going through some similar things like infertility or miscarriage and loss. And so I asked Kat to come share her story, and she very generously and bravely is going to. So Kat, thank you so much for doing this. And I think just first and foremost, just tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, all of that. I'm sure they'll hear your accent and be like, where is she from? So just tell us a little bit that you want to tell us about, and then I'll kind of cue us into the rest of the conversation.
Alrighty. I am Australian, obviously. I am Kat, a mum of three. I have a baby girl that lives up in the stars, and I have another girl and a boy. I live in regional Victoria, which is probably about 2 hours out of Melbourne, to the west. And yeah, I'm a stay-at-home mum at the moment, which is something new for me because I've usually worked full time since I was about 16. So this is a new experience for me.
That's awesome. I didn't realize that about you. What did you do before this? I don't even really know.
I am one of those people that is a jack of all trades but a master of none. I've worked in hospitality for like, oh, how old am I now? 20, 35, like nearly 20 years, in customer service. I've worked at a museum out here that is like an 1850s museum. I live in a gold rush town, so we have like a gold rush 1850s museum. So I dress up and interact with people. Like I can be a little bit, like to perform a little bit. So that was probably one of my favorite jobs. But yeah, I kind of have done a little bit of everything in my life.
I love that, the gold rush. Yeah, we have that too, actually, not too far from where we live in the mountains. There's a lot of that too. We can go gold panning and all that. That's the best. Okay. So let's just talk about, I think I want to start the conversation. Obviously, I mean, we're going to go from gold panning to very heavy topic, but so the reason that I wanted you to come on here primarily, although I learned a lot when we were kind of chatting before this conversation that I want to talk about, is that you lost your daughter, Amelia, and I want you to kind of walk us through, because your story is so, I think, unique in some ways and just really important. So, like I said yesterday, walk us through, as much or as little as you want to, but for those who are listening, who might want to understand a little bit more about her story, can you just kind of, I guess, start at the beginning, wherever the beginning is for you of that whole process, and what that looked like and what you guys went through when you lost Amelia?
Yeah, definitely. So 2014, I went into labor. I had a very, very predictable and not eventful pregnancy. Wasn't very sick at all, nothing really. All my scans were perfect, everything was great. Went into labor and went into spontaneous labor and off I went. And I was just like, right, this baby's coming out. After being sent home twice just for not really progressing, I finally just went, nope, I'm staying here until this baby comes. And I I was in active labor for a very long time, and nothing was kind of progressing past trying to push and all of that kind of stuff. And they kind of, I went to a small, low risk regional hospital in Western Victoria, and it was a midwife led hospital. So the obstetricians weren't actually on site. They were on call in different areas of the hospital or somewhere close by that they could be on call. So after I wasn't progressing for a while, they started to get a little bit concerned just because it was taking so long, called in the obstetrician, who's like, right, I'm going to try a vatus or a vacuum assisted birth, and we'll see if we can get this baby out. And she had two attempts and she was like, well, may have to go in for an emergency Caesar. So an hour and a half after the failed vatus births, attempts, I was wheeled into theatre. And it's really weird when I reflect on it, because a lot of people think that you kind of don't remember very well, but I remember everything completely and utterly like it happened yesterday. So I was wheeled into theatre, jumped on there, really ready. I'm like, right, I'm going to see baby now, sucking on my gas stick, because that's the only kind of pain relief that I was using. And I had watched a lot of one born every minute before birth in preparation. And I kind of was popped on the table, all numbed up, and was violently like being thrown from side to side. And I remember thinking, I've never seen someone give birth like a cesarean like this in one born every minute. And I've watched a lot of those episodes. And my midwife, who was specifically for me and standing next to me, just talking me through things, was called to the other side of the curtain. And I was like, what is going on? Everyone, like other nurses were coming in, and I was like, this is really weird. And Amelia was born and she wasn't crying. So they rushed her over to the resus table. And my anaesthetist, who was watching over all of my vitals and everything, suddenly left my side and raced over to the resus table, where they attempted to resuscitate Amelia for 25 minutes to no success. And I kind of, it was really weird to say it was an out-of-body experience because it sounds so cliche, but I literally felt like I was not inside my body. And they kind of said, sorry that your daughter has passed. What they had said had happened was that she was impacted in my pelvis. My midwife had come around to assist and push her back up through my pelvis, but she had the cord wrapped around her neck three times. And so they said that somewhere between me getting on the table and them getting her out, they believe that she had passed. And and so I was like, right. And I didn't cry, and it was really strange. It's like you go into shock, and I think you have a lot of medication going on. So, you know, I was like, oh, thank you so much for doing what you could. And we got wheeled into recovery and then wheeled back out into the ward, and my entire family were waiting in the waiting room, like waiting and waiting for this moment. And so I got wheeled out first, and then my partner at the time, he walked past the waiting room and had told everybody that she had passed. And so they all raced down, and I introduced her to everybody, and I got everybody to hold her. And I was actually very stoic for somebody who had just lost a baby. But so, you know, we got to spend a lot of time with her. We had a cold cot, or a cuddle cot that we call them here. And I think it's really important for people to spend time with their babies, even if they're passed. And we got to, you know, make memories, and trying to fit those memories into 3 days, bath her, talk to her, sing with her. Have an amazing charity in Australia called Heartfelt, who are professional photographers who come out and take photos of babies and children that are passing or will pass.
Yeah. Wow. So you actually were able to be there with her for like 3 days.
Yeah. So we got to, I was in there for 3 days, and we got to spend the entire 3 days with her. Which is a really nice thing to do. I feel like it. Yeah. It's quite empowering, because when you think about it, when you go in to give birth, you expect to leave with your child, and to I had to really prepare myself that I was going to leave her at the hospital and walk out empty-handed. And that was not something that I was mentally prepared to do. Right. So spending that time with her was essential for me to be able to go, right, she's going to have to stay here.
Yeah. So, okay, so this all happens and, you know, you all go home and you obviously have to process. And, of course, I know a little bit more about the story than other people. So before we go to kind of the next piece of her story, what was that like? What were the first like several months of that? Because this was your first pregnancy, correct? And like
correct,
your first child. I mean, you obviously said your whole family was waiting. So maybe, I don't know if there were a lot of grandchildren in the family or not, or if this was going to be like one of the first, but so what was your experience like with losing a child and grief in terms of, I think all the things that anyone listening probably had to go through, like people maybe acting awkward around you, not knowing what to say to you, people saying the wrong things, you know, people sending gifts, having to just go through that. I mean, what most people go through when someone loses someone, but also like losing a child and in the way that you did, like what did that grief process look like for you all?
Yeah, so I was very lucky. I had asked before we went home for her nursery door to be closed and for everything that around the house that would have triggered me to be taken out. So like the high chair and all of that kind of stuff, just popped in a room and closed the door. And when I was ready, I was going to deal with, you know, all of that emptiness. I think it's numbness that comes out first before anything else, because you're just in complete shock and your head replays every millisecond of time before labor, during labor, after labor, of what you as an individual could have done differently. And I was like, I shouldn't have eaten those Twiggy sticks the day, like a couple of days before. I shouldn't have done this. And then that kind of numbness, and then that thinking turns into anger, and I'm angry at, like, I want to be angry at somebody, but, you know, I was told at the hospital that these things just happen sometimes with babies, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're born and sometimes they die. Like, this is just part of life. And that is not something that you want to hear as a mother who has just lost her baby. You don't want to hear that that is just something that happens and that there is no reason for that to happen.
Yeah.
And then we started that whole process of, you know, you're in your bubble for a couple of weeks and then the funeral happens and then everybody's life just starts continuing, but yours is completely frozen. You're completely frozen in this grief that is all encompassing and completely dark, and you're just trying to find little bits of normality wherever you can and kind of cling to it. And whether that's clinging to each other or clinging to, you know, in my case, it was clinging to some kind of hope that I won't have her, but maybe one day I can, like, maybe one day I'll be able to be a mum. And so, yeah, it's funny how, because men and women grieve completely differently, and I had to learn that the very hard way.
Sure. That
I am a conversationalist, and for me to process, I need to be able to talk to people or talk to somebody and not have them want to fix whatever is happening in my life. I wanted to talk to people about her, make sure people remember her, put her in conversations, set a place at special occasions at the table for her during that first year, and kind of just make sure people remembered her. Whereas my partner at the time was a little bit different. He didn't process in those same ways. And so, yeah, it's all of those things. People, I kind of look at it as it's never linear. It's one of those crazy kind of like you hit this corner and then you hit this corner and you think you're doing okay and 2 days later you're not. You're in the fetal position on the floor and crying, holding onto her cardigan, which is like the only thing that she touched that you own because you've only seen her for 3 days. Like, it's just the most intense roller coaster that you cannot unbuckle yourself from. It is insane.
So as you're going through all of that, you know, I don't know if you had gotten to a place at this point in time where you were kind of like slowly coming out the other side. What point were you at in kind of your grief stages when you got, I guess it was like a phone call about what had happened?
Yeah, so I was kind of just at a point of what's the word? I was just surviving. Like I was just like, right, you're just going on with your life. You kind of don't know if you're okay. You are okay, but you're not okay. But, you know, it's been a year and a bit now. And you're like, well, this is just who I am for the rest of my life. Like I've just had to find little bits of myself and kind of mesh them and restitch them all together and go, this is the new me, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we received a phone call a year and 2 months later that there had been some developments in Amelia's story and her birth, and that asked if we could come down to the hospital and have a meeting. And I was like, oh, that's a bit odd. Wonder what that is. And we went down to the hospital and sat in the room, and a lady and a gentleman walked in, and they would have been from a third party that the hospital had hired. And they sat us down and said, now, tomorrow there's going to be some information all over the media, all over the country. And we thought that we would bring you in today, the day before, and let you know that there has been an ongoing investigation into the hospital in an 18-month period between 2013 and 2014. Because this is a low-risk hospital, there's not really women with complications or who they perceive to potentially have complications aren't allowed to birth there. This is a low-risk hospital. So between 2013 and 2014, in an 18-month period, there were 11 babies that had passed away at some capacity in that hospital. And of those 11 babies, 7, they have found that they could have been avoided. And Amelia was the last of those 7 babies that her death could have been avoided. And so they were just like, we just wanted to let you know, because it'll be out in the media tomorrow. People may seek you and want to interview you. So prepare yourself to be, you know, asked questions or found. And the hospital would really like to reimburse you for her funeral fees if you have receipts for them. To which many expletives came out of my mouth. Yes. And yeah, I was just like, I beg you, like, how offensive. Like, well, that is the most offensive thing you could have. I was complete shock. Then I howled completely and utterly, just howled. And I was like, so, like, she didn't have to die.
Yeah.
And I knew nothing else besides the fact that they said that it was completely avoidable, and the hospital were taking complete onus of everything that had gone on. Mm. So, yeah, we went to find out that turned out to be one of the largest failings of clinical governance and system failures the Victorian system had seen. Nurses, midwives, doctors, completely devoid of any training, didn't know how to read CTG monitoring, so wouldn't know if a baby was in distress. There was suboptimal, like, clinical notes. I didn't know how to take notes properly. There wasn't appropriate notes being taken. And at this point, once we started finding that out over the next couple of days, and it was just days of newspaper articles, front headline headings, every time I'd turn the TV on, there would be something about this going on in the news, and doctors were fleeing the country to their country of origin. The board was completely set, like, the hospital and the system was completely in disarray. And I was like, man, I should feel good about this. Like, that, not in the way that there's someone to blame now. So I had been, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I wish that I could be angry at somebody, and now I could be angry at somebody, but I wasn't angry at, like, I was just like, what is happening to our system that something like this has happened to so many people? I thought it was just me. I was told at the hospital that it's just, this is the first baby that, you know, has died in 15 years at this hospital by my obstetrician. I was like, right, it's just something that happened. So that was a year and a half after, and it literally kicked me right in the guts straight back to the beginning of my grief. Yeah. All of that work that I had done on myself was completely and utterly void. Like it never existed. And I had to retrace everything right from the beginning.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. I was trying to imagine that because you know, you get to this place where you kind of, yeah, you have a, it's almost like, I mean, it's not like, but it would be almost like, you know, getting a divorce and grieving and then finding out your partner had had an affair for 10 years you didn't know about. Now you're like, what? Like, you just have this whole new process to go through. So I can only imagine like what that new wave of grief was. Because like you said, it's layers of like anger and, okay, now I have to grieve the fact that my child didn't have to pass away and they did. Mm-hmm. So when all of that happened, did you have to go through like court proceedings? Did you ever connect with the other like six families that went through all of this? Like, how did any of that kind of come about?
Yeah. So we went to see lawyers, and they, at this point, the hospitals had gotten in contact with the major law firms in Melbourne and kind of said, these are going to be our terms. So this is how much we're willing to pay out in like outside of court. And then my lawyer, and we sat down with a lawyer, and they said, well, this is how much they're offering to just, you know, pay out outside of court, not take them to court. However, I need to tell you that in our law system, if you take them to court, you will not, she technically never lived. So technically she is not a person. So if she was alive, it would be a different story. But because she never breathed, she's not technically a person. So that was a very hard pill to swallow, that just because my daughter didn't take a breath, they wouldn't classify her as if a three-year-old had passed away due to medical negligence. It was completely, and I was blown away. I was like, rightio, so what does that mean? And he's like, it means you should take what they're offering you. And it was never about the money. I wanted justice. And I was like, justice for my daughter and justice for these families. But unfortunately, that's not the system that we're working with.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, so what happened, to the hospital system and all of that?
Yeah, so the hospital system got the entire Victorian hospital system and maternity system, especially regionally, got a revamp, as in, you know, lots of professional development for nurses, and the health minister kind of got involved and said, we're doing a whole rehaul and everyone's going to, there's going to be different procedures put in place so that this doesn't happen again, so that state bodies can come into hospitals and take audits more often, etc., which in hindsight I look at now and think, was it just that one hospital, or was that a scapegoat for a much, much bigger issue that was happening within our system? Yeah, sure. So we settled outside of court because I was like, I'm not going through years and years and years of reliving and retelling her story and trying to prove to people that this was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then with that came the loss of, you know, my relationship. You know, we lost I lost my home. I lost my relationship. And it just wasn't the same. And, you know, his story is obviously his, and I would never divulge any information, but people grieve completely differently. And in those situations, it's so hard to find common ground in your grief because you change, like your whole being changes as a person, and you're no longer the person after a first round of grief, let alone an entirely new round of grief.
Yeah, I know the stats. I was going to ask you about that because I know the stats on couples staying together through child loss are quite low. So do you feel like, I mean, obviously it's probably impossible to predict, but do you feel like if you had not found out, like if the hospital bit had never happened, do you think that would have shifted things? Like, did that change things for your relationship or for him that made it worse or too much like to go through for you as a couple? Or do you feel like either way, it probably would have affected your relationships just losing Amelia?
Yeah, I feel like that either way, I think that it may have affected the relationship.
Yeah.
In some way, whether it was sooner or later, like that holds a really lasting effect on people. Yeah, which is really sad. It's really sad that there isn't enough things put in place for parents after the loss of a child.
Yeah.
Together, let alone individually. And it's actually quite sad. Because you don't only lose one. It's not like it's like a snowball. It's mm-hmm. almost feels like one thing after another you start to lose.
Yeah, for sure. And then I know so many couples face like, you know, the pain of even, because I know I've gone through like even the infertility piece, like trying to put yourself back together to want to even try to have another child. Like it's mm-hmm. just so huge. So I can only imagine. Yeah, just all of those types of conversations and trying to navigate that is just a lot.
Mm. Yeah.
So you go through all these court cases. Everything happens at the hospital, mm-hmm. you know, and then obviously your relationship falls apart. Like you said, you lost your house. So where did that kind of bit end? And then I know you shared with me your long history of miscarriages. So I'm assuming down the road, you were in you started a different relationship, and that is when you started to try to have children again?
Yeah, it was kind of throughout. So this all kind of didn't really end, but as in like the last kind of piece of the puzzle was that a year after the court, the media kind of came out and said that this had happened, we'd gotten another call from APRA, which is the Health Practitioners Regulation Authority in Australia, and they had said, oh, just letting you know that we have found some records that had been ripped out of your file and stashed somewhere in the hospital to say that your daughter, that there was nurses that were resuscing Amelia to say that they had actually witnessed her breathing.
What?
And that had been taken from my file and put somewhere else.
Mm.
And so the third kick was my daughter may have actually been alive when for 2.5 years I had been told that she had not suffered and not died.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the last bit of her story. That for me was a breaking point for myself. Like that's when I spiraled. I was able to keep a lot of things together. I don't know what it was, but I could quite keep myself together. And that point I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, I am done with everything at that point. So miscarrying, my miscarriages, I had 10 from about 2015 to 2017. Most of them at about 7 weeks, and then I had one at 16 weeks and I just wanted to be a mum. And after losing Amelia, it's like you carry this baby for 9 months and you just love on this baby that you're growing inside you, and then that baby dies and you don't. You're so filled with this love that it has absolutely nowhere to go, and you're just bursting to just put it into something, and that love turns into that grief. And but it's still love. They say that love is grief with nowhere that has nowhere to go, or that grief is love with nowhere to go, or something like that. And that's what it feels like. You're just bursting and waiting. And people kind of say to people who have miscarried, who want to try again, they're like, oh, are you sure you want to try again so soon? And as a mum going through that, yes, I want to try again. Like, I want to have a baby. No, it's not going to replace Amelia, but I have this love that needs to be put somewhere, and I want to be a mum so badly. And so we started trying and miscarry and then miscarry, and the doctors are like, you just need to relax, a baby will happen, it's just because you're so stressed. And that made me just try even harder. And people were like, why? I would have like on my wall A3 pieces of paper with like dates and trackings and like I became obsessive because I was just like, what do you mean? So you're telling me that my daughter died for no reason, and then there was a reason, and then no, I had to control something. Something had to be my control, and that was my fertility and my journey.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, 10 babies or 10 miscarriages. I went through the first and then the second, and then the 16-week one was kind of my tipping point. The doctors kept telling me that tests were coming back and nothing was wrong with anything. And I was just like, I don't understand how that is possible. How is that possible that I keep miscarrying and you, that I'm paying money to see, like it's not like it's cheap to see you, are telling me, right, no, nothing is wrong with you. That's just bad luck. Well, that's a lot of bad luck for one person.
Yeah.
I don't believe you.
Yeah.
And so at about the 6-week mark, I kind of went, right, I'm going to try something a little bit different. And so I went to see a Chinese herbalist, and he kind of gave me all this tincture, and I started taking that and fell pregnant again, but miscarried again. And he said, you know, your body is in mourning. Your body is mourning this baby, and you need to fuel and fix your body from the inside and love your body from the inside and yourself from the inside before you can even, doctors can give you medicines. And he was very blunt. Doctors can give you medicine all they like and tell you that there's nothing wrong, but we need to heal your body and heal your soul before you can bring another baby into this world. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I don't know what does he mean by that? And then I started reading about toxic burden and kind of all of this stuff that you're putting all over yourself and in your home, and how that can impact your fertility. And I was telling my friend at the time, and she's like, oh, all that kind of conspiracy stuff. Okay, so yep, your foundation and your deodorant is directly linked to your miscarriages, Kat. Rightio. And I was like, yeah, but it makes sense though, doesn't it? She's like, makes no sense at all. There is no medical backing to say that that is the case. And at this point, my trust in the medical system was below zero, like Arctic freezing. And I was just like, no, there has to be something about this. There needs to be. And I think I was really clinging on to, I don't trust what any doctor says to me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to find my own way. And so I did miscarry 4 more times, and I'd found my current partner, Corey, and I had some surgery just to check out what was going on. I was like, I'm going to go see a doctor that I've heard really good things about. And he said to me, after he'd had a look at all of the reproductive stuff, said, I'm sorry to say, but your tubes are completely blocked with scar tissue, and there is no way that you're going to be able to have a baby. You're probably going to have to do IVF, and even then it's going to be a long journey. And I was like, oh my God, like, can you give me a break? Whether that's God or the universe or whoever is out there, please. Like, and I wasn't even sad about it, which is really, I think when you get kicked in the guts one too many times, you kind of just go, rightio, just another thing to add to the collection.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where I really dove into just cleaning my life and kind of swapping things out of my life that I thought would have an impact. Yeah. And that resulted, so I was supposed to start IVF in February of 2019.
Okay.
And I fell pregnant naturally in the November of 2018. And I gave birth to Grace in June.
That's so crazy. So like, how long was your kind of detox, you know, swapping process before you fell pregnant and had Grace?
So it started very slowly from the end of 2016, like just little bits and pieces that I would see here and there, like my laundry liquid and my deodorant. And then I just started getting a little bit more intense. And I think when I fully started like going down that rabbit hole, it was only because I had started a bit earlier. It was only 6 or 7 months before I fell pregnant naturally. And my doctor said medically that was impossible, completely impossible. You should not be pregnant. And I was like, well, you're wrong. Yet again, you're wrong.
So what was, I'm just thinking, I was like so many different questions in my brain, but like, so what was the process of, okay, so now you've had all this distrust in the medical system for, I mean, completely makes sense why you would, and you have doctors telling you you're never going to get pregnant again, you have to have IVF, and then you do get pregnant. And what was Grace's pregnancy like? Because I can only imagine after going through the loss of a child and then obviously, I mean, 10 more children and going through all those miscarriages. And then were you like holding your breath the whole time you were pregnant with her? Like, what was that pregnancy like?
Yeah. So it was, it was the most difficult thing besides losing Amelia that I have ever done, ever. I was anxious. It's like I had, when I was speaking to other mums who had lost babies and then subsequently had another baby, they had always had a point of their pregnancy that was like their safe point. So like 16 weeks or 20 weeks or, but I didn't have a safe point. Like,
right.
There was no safe point that I could get to in my pregnancy where I kind of went, whew, and could breathe again. And so my anxiety just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And all I could think of and was that I couldn't grow attached to this baby because there was a possibility that I was going to lose her and have to go through that all over again.
So did you feel like you, so I imagine like it probably was a very like unenjoyable pregnancy. Like, I mean, not that pregnancy, well, some people really enjoy it. I never loved it, but I still feel like it was, probably high stress the whole time. Because I know even us just not being able to get pregnant for years, when I finally did, I was like, well, how do I know my body can even carry a baby? How do I know I won't have a miscarriage? So yeah, I know. And I know the thought process. So yes, you get to the point where you're probably not enjoying your pregnancy. And then what was it like when you went into labor?
Yeah. So I already knew from when I had my like investigative surgery that the theater room was a trigger for me. And my obstetrician had said that he's like, you might have some PTSD because I would get flashbacks and like, just memory flashbacks that would just make me freeze. And going into the theater room to have Grace, everything looks the same in every theater room in every hospital. And I just saw Amelia everywhere. And I remember them pulling Grace out and Grace crying, and I could not hear her cry. And I kept saying to Corey, my partner, is the baby crying? Is the baby crying? He's like, she's crying. Can you hear her? There she's fine. And I could not hear her and I could not see her moving. And I was just like, I was sure that she had died. And it was such a weird feeling. And so, that time after her, once I'd had Grace, I got really severe postnatal depression and anxiety, really severe. And I was very lucky that the hospital that I birthed her at have a very great maternal health kind of mental health unit. So they helped me through that. But, it was quite severe. I just couldn't bond with her because that part of me that had lost Amelia was so, so scared of losing Grace that I couldn't grow attached to her. And then I felt guilty because I was like, I've been waiting for her for years and she's here and I can't, like, I just can't bring myself to love her like I felt like I was going to. And it was that those two conflicting feelings were, made it not very enjoyable. And I was sad. I was sad a lot of the time. And even looking back on it now, like, it makes me sad to think that I ever felt like that, because I mean, I don't anymore. I was very much able to work through all of that, but it took time. It takes time. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did that finally land for you in terms of, so you were obviously, getting some help through the program, and when did you kind of feel like,
I guess that bond or that connection with her started to grow?
I did a lot of work with that unit, and she would have probably been 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
When I finally was able to kind of go, yeah, I finally have a bond with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped feeling that anxiety, because I think after that time and after she started being able to hit milestones, it kind of felt like, okay, I think she's going to stay.
Mm.
Which was weird. And I feel like, so I had Grace, and then when she was about 6 months old, I fell pregnant with Noah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they're only 15 months apart. And that first trimester of hormones all changing with Noah was almost directly correlated with my depression, which, you know, makes sense when your hormones are changing and everything's going awry. But I couldn't correlate that because I didn't know I was pregnant at the time. But looking back on it now, I was very, very lucky that I could get through that darkness, dark, before I was properly pregnant with Noah, because Noah's pregnancy was completely different.
So how did you, so now that you had Grace and things were kind of starting to shift for you, do you feel like you were able to enjoy Noah's pregnancy and birth in a different way?
Yeah, I was just a lot less stressed, because I kind of, when you lose so many babies, you think something's wrong with you.
Yeah.
And you're like, so I always thought, before I found out that Amelia's was the hospital's fault, I thought there was something wrong with me. And then, even though I knew that it was their fault, after 10 miscarriages, I'm like, there is something wrong with me. And I was that it was all me. And so finally having a baby and her being safe, I finally felt like that there wasn't anything wrong with me anymore, that I could have a healthy baby that was here, and that was okay, and that if I did it once, that I can probably do that again. And that's kind of what I clung to during Noah's pregnancy, was I've already done this now. Like, I've done it and it was successful. There was still anxiety. There's always going to be anxiety.
Right.
There's going to be anxiety all through their lives, because I'm just, a part of me is always, always waiting for something to happen to one of them. And that sounds morbid, but...
No.
Yeah, a part of you is always going to be waiting.
Yeah. I feel that. And even as a woman who hasn't had a miscarriage or loss of a child, I mean, I feel that way. I definitely think that that's very much so a normal experience in terms of being a parent and just worrying that something, terrible is going to happen to your children. So. What I was saying was, so if you had someone who was listening to this and they were resonating with, like, whether it be the loss of a child, maybe it happened to them, or they're going through repeat miscarriage and some of this is resonating with them and they're maybe just at a loss for where to go next or what to do, like, what were things that you feel like you're glad you did, or are there things you wish you had done? Like, what are pieces of advice for people who are experiencing, I guess let's just start with grief and loss in general, like the loss of a child, whether it be through miscarriage, through stillborn, anything like that. Like, what would you tell them helped you the most, or what do you wish you had done?
It would definitely be, firstly, to give yourself grace and to be able to feel all of the feelings that you're feeling. There is no timeline, and there is no coming out the other side, and there's no being healed and feeling better, and that none of that exists. It is all just words that people give to you to try and make you feel like that you have to feel better. It is allowing yourself to feel that sadness when it comes knocking at your door, which it will do your whole life, but being able to hold on to the good that you remember from that. Because I have a cardigan that I hold when I miss her, and I look through her photos and I kind of go, well, without having had lost her, I would not have Noah and Grace now. I would not be the person that I am and have gone through all of those hurdles without have losing her. So she has essentially made me into who I am. And I think that it is also to seek out community and to speak about your child and to not feel like that you your story has to be silenced or your child's story has to be silenced just because it makes other people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. So,
yeah, making other people uncomfortable has nothing to do with you and everything to do with them. So I like implore parents to speak about their children, speak about their stories, despite of how other people feel about it, because other people, if they don't want to hear about it, they can walk away.
Right.
Yeah. It's super important to seek community and speak. So healing to speak.
Yeah, that's really good advice, because I think that is something that I'm sure a lot of people feel. Yeah, it's like you just feel like you can't or you shouldn't or, yeah, what is someone going to think? And so, I can imagine that – and I would imagine for most people it would be very cathartic, you know, to tell their story and to speak about them and to be able to continue to process and remember them. So it is really terrible that a lot of people probably feel like they can't do that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So the last thing is that I wanted to ask you is, so if people are listening and, you know, they just want to reach out to you because they're going through the same thing or they want to learn from you or ask you questions, maybe they've gone through a similar process with the hospital system or just whatever it might be, where can they find you?
Well, I am I'm on Instagram at patchwork.hearted.mama. And yeah, that's kind of where I've got bits and pieces on there, but I'm happy for people to reach out. I am all for being a beacon of voice for women who just feel like that they are alone, because I am a testament of not being alone. And there are many, many people on this same path. And that loneliness is what carries us into the darkness. And essentially what we all want to find is that light. So
Yeah, that's so good. That's so true. Well, I will add I'll add your Instagram link to the show notes so people can connect directly with you there. And I just want to say thank you again for sharing all this, for Amelia's story, for just all of it. I think that it's something that I know a lot of people will listen to and be really moved and blessed by. And I also think that it'll become an amazing resource for people who maybe are afraid to tell their story or are just sitting in grief and loss and feeling like they're alone and no one else understands. And so I just thank you so much again for doing this.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm blessed that you even asked me to be a part of it. Thank you so much.